From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
I'm Adam Cano, co-chair of the National Press Club's broadcast podcast team. September marks the National Press Club's annual photo exhibit, and this year's theme is the climate crisis. Joining me from Arizona is Ben Sereo, a documentary photographer whose photos are on display in the category of extreme effects. Ben, welcome to Update One.
Adam, hey, thank you for having me on Update One.
Let's start with you before we get to the work that's on display. When did you get your start in journalism and generally and photography in particular?
Oh, that goes back. You know, I was studying history at Seton Hall University in the early 1970s. There were anti-war demonstrations on campus in South Orange as well as in New York City. And I went to these demonstrations with my camera and soon realized that these events were highly emotional, but once they were over, there's not too much media about them left. I asked one of my history instructors if photography was considered a acceptable methodology to document historical events. He said yes. I decided to study photography. The Institute of Design, also known as the New Bauhaus at IIT in Chicago, was considered the preeminent university for photography with a graduate program. At ID, they made images, not photographs, the difference being that images are conscious constructs. The head of the program, Arthur Siegel, was the last photographer to be hired by the Farm Security Administration. He taught the history of photography and documentary imaging. He was a taskmaster and a tough but fair. As the head of the program, Siegel's presence was close to that of the mythical movie character Professor Charles Kingsfield in The Paper Chase. At the time, I had a cousin who volunteered at a home for exceptional children in the suburbs of Chicago. She told me about the mysterious children who cannot be diagnosed for their unusual birth defects. I visited the center with her and was taken aback. I left and thought about it, went back in and asked the administrator if I could make images of the children there. The administrator agreed, and upon showing the images in class, Siegel eloquently spoke of the work and then closed with a warning. Ben can become famous for these images in New York City. It's where he's from. And I was sort of taken aback by that, but in the New York mythical world of Marvel Comics, Siegel's quip, if spoken to Peter Parker, would be, "With great powers come great responsibilities." I thought about that, and I thought that this is what really photography can be. It has a great opportunity to do good. And decades later, I learned that some of these children with birth defects actually received them from parents who had been in Vietnam and had been using Agent Orange.
Yeah, which certainly, we know had tremendously devastating effects. So, that's certainly one very notable assignment, but what other ones sort of stand out so far in your career and sort of the arc that your career has taken as a documentary photographer?
I would think that one of the interests that I had early on, even going to the Institute of Design, was technology. And so I was very interested in the space program, the early American space program. I did a second thesis because I was having so much fun. It was on 75 years of flight. Mm. I was starting to document American space centers across the United States, and I continued that for a number of years. That work ended up being shown several times at the headquarters of NASA in Washington, D.C.
That's very cool. I want to get to the work that's on display in a little bit, but before that, you talked about the technology that's at NASA. There is, of course, technology is changing journalism tremendously. There's a lot of talk about the effect of different technologies now, including AI. I'm kind of curious as to your perspective on journalism and technology from a photographer's perspective and what you've seen so far, and especially what you see recently.
It's expanding, and I think that everyone has what I call the third eye, and that's the iPhone. And mostly people are seeing things and doing things. And what has been the result of it, I think, has been an ever sharpening idea of our consciousness worldwide and globally. We see things instantaneously. We learned about media news events, not the next day or the next week, but maybe that same day, that same afternoon, that same evening, within minutes. Regarding artificial intelligence, well, that's another bag. I think that's a real interesting one. AI can never say, been there, done that. What my think of AI is, it's like a multimedia dictionary where one can plug and play the output from algorithms written by a team who have captured someone else's experiences,
mm-hmm.
but not yours, or not theirs even. And so in the long run, human experiences, I think, will remain as vital tomorrow as they are today. As a side note, you know, I wrote a prospectus on artificial intelligence for the USIA that was creating the U.S. Pavilion at the Tsukuba World Fair back in 1985.
Wow.
And that was before Mark Zuckerberg was born. So the idea of AI has been around for a while. But I will say that AI will remain as entertaining parlor game like charades till people tire of the canned logic and can start inputting their own audio, visual, and data into the substrate of the program. And once they do that, it'll no longer be called artificial intelligence. It'll be closer to RI, real intelligence.
Really interesting perspective. Thank you for that. Let's start to talk now about the topic of drought. It's something that is, you know, increasingly common in a lot of parts of this country, certainly up and down the West Coast. It's something you've seen firsthand. You based now in Arizona, but you were in Seattle previously, and even the Pacific Northwest, part of the country we don't normally think about in terms of drought, has seen that happen. And this drove you to self-publish a book about drought. So tell us a little bit about that.
Drought was the name of the book. When I first moved to the Seattle area back in 2001 with my wife, Suzanne, or soon to be wife, Suzanne, I realized that the winters there were very wet, and the springtimes were not as wet, but the summers were hot and dry. And as the decades went on from 2001, they were getting drier and drier. And they were getting more fires in the forests nearby. And at the same time, when we decided to move to Mesa, Arizona in 2018, the region was in drought. The severity of this drought caused a massive wildfire in the national park, Tonto, and it threatened nearby communities. And this drought extended into the western part of California, Nevada, Oregon, and even Washington state. So I went to all these areas and I started documenting the hillsides that had been burning to the ground, witnessed farms ablaze, meadowlands ablaze. And it really became apparent to me that this was not going to end. And I think that NOAA and NASA even had predictions that this was going to go on for another decade, maybe, or more. So it wasn't going to go away. And I thought that it was time to do a book on it. And after about 3 years of photographing the West Coast, I did a book on drought. It was self-published. I submitted the book to what is called PX3 in Paris. It's an international photography exhibit center, and received recognition for the work.
Fast forward a couple of years, you were among the first to photograph the Pacific Palisades and Bluffs fires in Los Angeles earlier this year.
Yeah.
What drew you there?
Well, you know, I kept hearing about it in the news and reading about it online, and this wasn't ending. This was going on for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. This fire wasn't contained. And I said to myself, well, if it's not contained, when could I go there, when it would be contained? And all of a sudden, there was a burst of rain that they hadn't gotten in LA for almost a year. And it basically drenched most of the fire and put it out. And I got in my car. I had been speaking with the LA Fire Department and the media group there. And it was time to go there to document what remained of the Palisades area. I was really sort of taken aback. There were people who were saying things quietly, like this reminded them of Hiroshima, although Hiroshima was a 1 millisecond event, and this was weeks in the making. I looked at this event. I was visually shaken. Besides the week and a half I was first there, and the second week, I could have been there for 6 weeks and not have covered half of the damage done.
Talk more about the opportunities, but also the challenges associated with speaking with residents and first responders, and also, frankly, the ethics behind the reportage when you're dealing with issues of life and property loss.
It took me aback, and I had some experience working in documenting New York City and the residents of the city who are in a very positive atmosphere and not in one that where people had just lost their homes, maybe members of their family or their pets, and had to start afresh. And by the way, when I talk about the Palisades firestorm, I'm really not talking about me or my work. I'm really talking about the residents of LA and what happened to them. And I tried to feel like the images I was making fairly represent what they have lost, what their property now looks like. There are some people there I just talked with briefly. I would never ask them to make their photograph. There were people there collecting a few belongings, and they were having private moments. And you need to respect that. You really need to give people a sense that it's their life. It's not my life. I'm there to see what has happened, but it's their life. And the few people I spoke with every day, I could see in their eyes literally a sorrow. I mean, and sort of some of them were shell-shocked, essentially, from what had happened. My sensibilities were to be there and listen. And a lot of times I would just walk around the area with my camera. And I know there are people who are documenting there on electric scooters and doing what I call drive-by shooting. But I was there to see. And also experience. You know, seeing and experiencing don't have to be separate things if done with some compassion.
No.
So my sensibility was to speak with people, and if they wanted to speak with me, that was fine. To listen to people and to share what their lives were like. There's one gentleman who I noted, he didn't lose his home, but he was upset. He was very upset about what had happened. And rightly so. And he didn't like the news coverage. He said that it was just for weeks, it was just nonstop news of the fire. Nonstop. He said, it's fire porn. And I said, yeah, I can understand that. I can understand that week after week, 24 hours a day, 3 weeks in a row, 4 weeks in a row, if that's all you're seeing, that's terrible. It's terrible to witness day in, day out. It was a humbling place to be. The firemen were exhausted. The people slowly came back after the 29th. They were finally allowed in to look at the what was left of their properties. They were greeted by the Red Cross, who were very kind, very supportive of them. I wasn't sure I would go back a second time. But after a week and a half, I said, okay, I'll go back and start making a few more photographs or images of the recovery. There were fewer residents there. It was mostly teams from the state and from the city who were trying to get power back on and bringing in AT&T trucks for cell phone services and stuff like that so they could communicate with each other in the fire zone.
You have six photos in the NPC exhibit. Tell us about a couple of them.
I think the one that really stood out to me was Ramos. He owned a property and he was there in his hazmat suit. And I asked him if I could make his photographs. And talking about ethics of photography, I only make photographs of people if they agreed to let me photograph them. I don't believe in this taking photographs. I make photographs of people who agreed to let me make their photograph. And he agreed to let me photograph him. And he just stood there. And in his driveway, what was left of it, it was a time that he was there. I don't know if I never saw him again after that day.
Wow.
One of the other photographs that stands out is this image of the pool where there's a group of privacy bushes around the pool. And you can see that the bushes are gone. It's just there's sticks remaining. And you can see what's the pool is there. And sometimes that's all that's left is a pool, a driveway, a sidewalk. And that's about it. Another image that I thought was important is the two sisters, Dina and Gina. They were there and they had a lot of chutzpah. They were going to really clear the ground and they wanted to rebuild their mother's home. And they had some great memories, they told me, of their parents' mother's home. And so they were there and they were one of the first people to actually clear their property of the debris from the fire. I thought a lot of them. I thought that if there's hope, these two young women are it.
Well, let's end on that. The fires, you know, eventually extinguished, but the impact and the suffering lingers far beyond that. Talk about those long-term issues and the role of organizations like the Red Cross.
I think that if we start thinking about long-term issues with severe firestorms, we're talking about not necessarily LA, we're talking about Canada, we're talking about Brazil, Australia, Greece, even Russia has had huge, massive wildfires that have devastated large parts and regions of their country. And so this is not an anomaly anymore. This is not a one-off event. And I think that in terms of how we think about these events, I think as part of the media, we need to put the dots together and understand that these are not individual events. They're happening around the world. And that is probably the strongest reason to think about how we need to approach climate change globally and not think that any one country can go it alone. One of the things I saw in LA that struck me was that I mentioned this, the driveways that were left, the cars were burned, the driveways were left and the sidewalks were left. So maybe we need to start walking a little bit more and driving a little bit less. Even though I was in LA, there was still a lot of traffic jams, if you know the LA traffic jams. So my sensibility is walk more, drive less, maybe. Is it that simple? Yes. And in terms of global climate change, it's global. It's not just the United States. And in terms of what we can do here in this country to help people until this is fixed, I thought the American Red Cross was there for the people and ready to help the people. In fact, they've just rolled out in April a second campaign to help fund people who are affected by this firestorm in LA. If we start looking at the organizational groups that have staying power, I think that if people are behooved to support those groups, they should look at the long-term effects of how groups stay with a community and just don't pack up and go with thoughts and prayers.
Ben, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Ben Sorreo's photographs are part of this year's National Press Club photo exhibit on display here in Washington. For Update One, I'm Adam Kahn.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.